This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a California prosecution that has literally cost $500,000 and a year's worth of resources. The defendants? 11 Muslim college students who were arrested for disrupting a speech by Israel's ambassador to the U.S.
BDS, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction Movement, was launched in 2005. It calls upon conscientious citizens of the world to hold Israel accountable. Co-host Michael Ratner interviewed independent Palestinian commentator and human rights activist Omar Barghouti, who was in New York on his book tour. Omar Barghouti is the author of the just-published BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights.
Stay with us.
City Attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
In what seems to be a growing government trend of prosecuting outspoken supporters of Palestine, 11 Muslim students were arrested for disrupting a speech. In this case, that of the ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren. The incident took place last year on the campus of the University of California at Irvine. The local district attorney claims that the students had no right to disrupt the event, charging them with conspiracy to shut down the ambassador's speech, even though he was able to complete that speech. Supporters claim that the Muslim students' actions are protected by the First Amendment and that they are being charged for being vocal critics of Israel. Defense attorneys assert that the district attorney has acted irregularly, first by using an investigative grand jury to look into felony charges, even though the students were charged with two misdemeanors. Second, in the course of the investigation, prosecutors obtained vast personal electronic records from Google and Hotmail. They then released some of these documents to the media in what appears to be an attempt to influence public opinion against the 11 students. Joining us now to talk about the case is one of the attorneys for the Irvine 11, Daniel Mayfield. Welcome, Dan, to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Now, I know in the National Lawyers Guild and here on Law and Disorder, we've heard a lot about the so-called Irvine 11. Can you briefly describe who they are?
The Irvine 11 are 11 students, 8 from the University of California at Irvine and 3 from the University of California at Riverside, who were arrested on February 8th, 2010, during a speech by Michael Oren, who is the Israeli ambassador to the United States.
Now, this was a campus event. It was a relatively peaceful disruption, wasn't it?
As far as disruptions go, it's about the most peaceful that you could ever imagine. What happens is that Michael Oren is invited to speak on campus. It is a hybrid event. He is partially sponsored by off-campus organizations and partially sponsored by on-campus organizations, but it is an official campus event. There is, however, a private reception beforehand, and that ends up being important to the case. The people who are at the private reception have access to the meeting room prior to the event. So when the event begins, the people who've been at the private reception, supporters of Mr. Oren, are all in the middle of the auditorium and close to the front. People who then have not been at the private reception, which would include the 11 defendants, are allowed to come in, and then they have to occupy the sides of the auditorium away from the speaker. When Mr. Oren begins to speak, he speaks for, say, roughly a minute or two. The first of the 11 defendants stands up and interrupts him, makes a statement about Gaza and the Israeli invasion of Gaza. That person then walks to the edge of the auditorium and submits to arrest and is removed from the auditorium.
Let me clarify, is the arrest by campus police
or is it
local law enforcement?
There actually are roughly 5 law enforcement groups, present. The actual arrests are carried out by campus police. But there are campus police, Irvine police, county sheriffs, Secret Service agents, Israeli agents, the Diplomatic Protection Service, which is an arm of the Secret Service. There are a large number of law enforcement agencies present. In any case, Mr. Oren then starts his speech again, and he speaks for another 2 minutes or so, and the next student stands up and makes a statement. There's a large amount of jeering, clapping, people both opposed to Mr. Oren, people opposed to the students get involved. This happens 11 times. After the 11th student stands up, all of the students who have come in, or well, all of the students who are opposed to Mr. Oren, then stand up, start a chant, and they leave.
Okay.
Mr. Oren then finishes his speech.
And so then, as I understand it, the university launched its own investigation shortly after, concluded that investigation probably June of last year, and then the district attorney undertook its own investigation and recently has charged the students with disruption, conspiracy to disrupt.
Both, two misdemeanors. The conspiracy to disrupt and actually disrupting the speech. So the University at Irvine and the University of California at Riverside have separate investigations of their students, and the students are internally disciplined. The Muslim Students Association at Irvine is ordered off campus for 6 months, and by June, everybody thinks the case is over.
Right.
And about that time, the district attorney's office begins their own investigation. They send out an investigator to interview people. In December of 2010, the district attorney's office of Orange County, now remember this is Orange County, California, one of the most conservative places in America, they convene a grand jury. Now, under California law, you can only convene a grand jury if you are investigating a felony. They claim that they're investigating a felony. They pray for and get search warrants from a judge. You don't have to go to the judge and say, I need a search warrant. In their affidavits with the search warrants, they swear under penalty of perjury that they're investigating a felony. They call witnesses to this grand jury. When they are challenged, they tell the judge that they are investigating a felony. And then the grand jury does not issue an indictment. Now, it's unclear, and we don't know the answer to this yet, for whether they're even asked to issue an indictment.
Could it have been the so-called political fishing expedition to get more information on these individuals?
That's very, yes. Their term for it would be an investigative grand jury.
Right.
In that sense, not that different from what's happening in Chicago with the grand jury that involves the Palestinian activists in Chicago at Minneapolis City
right.
Hall. So then, at the close of the grand jury, the DA has amassed all of this material. They have gotten phone records and email messages. They have illegally...
They've asked these individuals to turn that over, and they did.
No, they asked Google, Hotmail, Gmail, all of those email companies were served with search warrants.
Right.
Saying, we are investigating a felony, turn over these emails from these students.
Oh.
And they do. Thousands and thousands and thousands of emails. 10 CDs of emails.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
They issue subpoenas to the university for the student's internal files. Now, your files as a student are protected under California privacy law and federal privacy law. The university rolls over and supplies these internal files directly to the grand jury and to the DA.
Was there an attempt made to intervene and have the university file a motion to quash?
Well, we didn't know about it.
Oh, I see.
What can you say?
Got it.
If we had known, we might have done something. But remember, grand juries
operate
are
in secrecy, right?
And people are told, this is secret. You cannot discuss it.
Right. So the university couldn't disclose that they'd received that.
The university should have come in and fought it, frankly.
Right.
But they did not. Don't know why. Presumably, they were just intimidated. So you have this whatever, grand jury, investigative fishing expedition. It's not clear. But they don't, in the end, do anything. Grand jury doesn't.
The grand jury, right.
They don't vote on an indictment.
Right.
They don't issue what's called a true bill.
Right.
Charging anybody with anything. Then, 363 days after the event, and remember there's a one-year statute of limitations on misdemeanors, 363 days, two days before the statute runs,
right,
the district attorney's office issues a complaint for two misdemeanors. Conspiracy to disrupt a speech and actually disrupting a speech. And they charge the 11 students then with two misdemeanors by complaint. And here we are 2 months later.
I understand that the phrase disruption comes from Section 403 of the California Penal Code. And that's what they've been charged under. And it says that it's illegal to disrupt certain kinds of meetings. Does that have anything to do with political meetings?
The code section specifically speaks about meetings that are not political or religious.
It's not okay to interrupt a religious or political meeting.
Those meetings are governed by different code sections.
Oh, I see.
There is a specific code section about disrupting religious ceremonies. There's a specific penal code section for that. So that's excluded from this general code section. And as far as political meetings are concerned, that's actually covered by a couple California Supreme Court cases which hold that if you are going to be involved in politics, you have to expect that people are going to heckle you and disrupt, as long as it's not, you know, violent disruption.
Right.
That you have to expect that there's going to be heckling at a political meeting.
And that's interrupting.
Part of what it's about.
Right.
Heckling, interrupting. We've seen a lot of this lately with the Tea Party going to public meetings of members of Congress. President Obama was interrupted, of course, during his State of the Union speech a year ago. It's that kind of thing that you, if you're going to be involved in politics, you have to be willing to hold the floor. That's the problem here.
So, Dan, is the goal here to avoid a trial and to get the district attorney to drop these charges?
I would state it a little differently. I don't believe the district attorney is going to drop these charges. They've dumped roughly $500,000 into this case.
No. Into the investigation?
Into the investigation, the grand jury. They've assigned, at this point, three deputy district attorneys, including two of their primary homicide DAs.
Homicide?
Homicide DAs. We're not dealing with brand new misdemeanor district attorneys who are in the office for...
These are veteran members of the department. Oh, my goodness.
We have veteran homicide district attorneys pulled off of homicides to work on two misdemeanors.
And so clearly this has, whether or not we can deem this a political meeting, the whole case has significant political import.
Definitely. But our goal is to win this case on motions.
And what does that mean for our listeners?
That because the meeting is political, because political meetings are excluded from the penal code section that we're interested in here, that we believe that we can win this case by arguing on the law before the judge that they do not have the right to proceed. We're bringing several motions that have to do with that kind of thing, in particular what's called a demur, which is sort of similar to a motion to dismiss, saying that they do not have the right to proceed as they have done.
Now, I understand that the district attorney has spoken out publicly about this case. Can you talk briefly about the kind of media attention it has received?
There's been a great deal of media attention. The various parties have been on national public radio nationally and locally in Los Angeles. The district attorney himself appeared on Fox News nationally talking about the case. There have been interviews, of course, with all kinds of media outlets. Most recently, the district attorney assigned to our case, so the deputy district attorney assigned to our case, made a 15-minute long infomercial that has been placed on YouTube. Talking about this case.
Dan, let's talk about UC Irvine for a second. I understand that 100 of the faculty members there did sign a petition asking that the DA drop these charges. Is it a hot issue on campus?
It's a very hot issue on campus. It's not, by the way, 100 professors at UC Irvine. It's 100 professors throughout the university system. There are 10 campuses of the university who signed, it's 100 Jewish professors, actually, who signed a petition to the district attorney and to the president of the whole university system, asking them not to proceed with criminal charges. On campus at Irvine, this has been, you know, a hot issue now for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And there are editorials in the paper and continuing demonstrations and discussions on campus about this now for 16 months.
It's part of a disturbing trend that we've seen around the country over the last several years on academic campuses where, unfortunately, often pro-Israeli factions apply pressure to either fire faculty who speak out about injustices. Were you surprised that this happened at UC Irvine? I understand you're an alum of that institution.
Yeah, I was. I did graduate from Irvine. I graduated in 1974. I started in 1967, so as my father referred to it, I was a slow learner. When they've had a series of incidents at UC Irvine, and for that matter, a series of incidents around the whole University of California campuses, all 10 campuses. The boycott, divest, and sanctions movement has members on all campuses. It's been something that's been coming up in the student senates all over. The speech by Michael Oren was specifically thought of as being a response to the organizing around the BDS work. And that's why it was this hybrid speech where they brought in outside groups as well as on-campus groups to sponsor the speech. And David Horowitz is written about Irvine in particular and put it on his Campus Watch webpage. So I was not surprised at the response that occurred. I was surprised, frankly, that the district attorney's office got involved 6 or 8 months after the event and started their own separate investigation. I'll just go back to that. Everybody truly believed that this matter was over in June when the students had been internally disciplined, the organization had been put on notice, and it was over as far as the university was concerned.
In the matter of misleading the grand jury, into thinking this was a felony investigation. Is there any recourse after the fact to charge the DA with abuse of authority?
Well, I don't know so much about the question of charging the DA with abuse of authority, but it does mean that they have gathered evidence illegally. It's even though they used a search warrant, that you can attack the search warrant. So we essentially will be arguing that the judge who signed the search warrant was lied to.
Right.
Therefore, the search warrant is no good.
Right.
Therefore, the information gathered by the search warrant should be suppressed.
Fruit of the poisonous tree, as it were.
And, right. So the... In that sense, the illegal grand jury or the illegal parts of the grand jury should not be used in this misdemeanor case. One of the problems we have is that the district attorney's office has all this material. They have been selectively releasing it to the news media.
The information that they obtain through their subpoenas?
Yes.
That sounds highly irregular.
It's very irregular, and one of the first motions that is going to be heard is a motion to recuse the district attorney's office. In other words, to remove them from the case.
Yes.
And that's going to be heard in June, and part of that motion is that they have acted irregularly, that they've engaged in misconduct by releasing or selectively releasing items from the grand jury, which are supposed to be secret, which they are in possession of, and
right.
We're not.
Right.
And to try their case in the media.
So exactly.
We're doing our best to move against that, and that motion will be heard in mid-June. This Friday we have motions having to do with sealing the grand jury to make sure that nothing else gets released illegally, and hopefully to get a court order against the district attorney's office in terms of their irresponsible media statements.
Dan, I had no idea that this was such a dramatic series of events. How many other lawyers are working on this case with you?
That we have... 8 lawyers on the case now, 11 defendants. So probably by the time we get to trial, we'll be up to 11 defendants and 11 lawyers.
Got it. So it really will be the Irvine 11 in every sense of the word.
A good group of people, so it's very exciting.
We are thrilled that you're able to take time out to really so carefully go over the case with us. I appreciate that. And we wish you the best of luck and hope to be having you back on Law and Disorder when we can celebrate a victory.
I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Dan Mayfield, right. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Heidi. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
BDS, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction Movement, was launched in 2005. It calls upon conscientious citizens of the world to hold Israel accountable to international law and the principles of human rights. The BDS movement urges citizens to support the rights of Palestinian people, that Israel end its 1967 occupation of their land, that it end the system of racial discrimination in Israel, and allow the right of return of the refugees in accordance with UN Resolution 194. Disinvestment calls for the divestiture from companies and institutions and universities that support Israel's occupation and lobbying power. Omar Barghouti is the author of the just-published BDS, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. Co-host Michael Ratner interviewed independent Palestinian commentator and human rights activist Omar Barghouti, who was in New York on his book tour.
Omar Barghouti, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Well, Omar, I've been reading your incredible new book, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. And I have to say, it's extremely, extremely provocative. I mean, even for people who are very pro-Palestinian, I think it makes a lot of really important points. Let's just start at the beginning. What is BDS? What does it stand for? What are its demands?
The BDS movement was launched in 2005. We launched a BDS call, which specifically calls upon citizens of the world, conscientious citizens, civil society, to shoulder the moral responsibility of holding Israel accountable to international law and principles of human rights. Specifically, the BDS call urges support to achieve three basic rights: UN-sanctioned rights of the Palestinian people, ending the 1967 occupation, ending the system of racial discrimination within Israel, which, according to UN definition of apartheid, fits the bill as apartheid. And the third and most important right is the right of return for refugees in accordance with UN Resolution 194. The point is, the BDS call addresses the three main segments of the Palestinian people, and that's often forgotten. Since the Oslo Accords, signed by the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the government of Israel in 1993, the definition of the Palestinian people in the mainstream media and people's minds has been reduced to just those in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, including East Jerusalem.
I think that's a critical point. I mean, I think when you read your book, already in the introduction, many of us think, okay, occupied territories, let's get Israel out of the occupied territories, and it's okay. And they forget about what's happening within Israel, what's happening to Palestinians in Israel, and the right of return.
Absolutely.
So let's look at those. I think most people understand Israel shouldn't have an inch of ground in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. That seems very clear. For many people in America, those two other concepts are quite important: what's happening within Israel and the right of return.
Yeah. The main issue is that the question of Palestine did not start in 1967. With the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. It started in 1948 with a massive campaign of premeditated, systematic ethnic cleansing that several historians, including the Palestinian Walid Khalidi, the Israeli Ilan Pape, and many others, have very well documented. It was a systematic campaign to ethnically cleanse the majority of the indigenous Palestinians so that Israel can create a Jewish majority state. A Judeo-centric state, if you will, an ethnocentric state. So the majority of the Palestinian people ended up becoming refugees. And they live in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and all over the world, in the US, and so on. Two-thirds of the Palestinian people are not under occupation. Only one-third live under Israel's occupation in the occupied territories. So ending the occupation addresses the basic rights of one-third of the Palestinian people. And that wouldn't even be an accurate statement, because if you take Gaza, which is still under siege and under occupation, about 80% of the residents of Gaza are refugees. According to international law, they have the right to go back home, to the homes from which they were expelled.
It's international law. It's also UN Absolutely. Resolutions. It also was the position after 48 of the United States.
Absolutely. And we look at the Bosnian case, at the Kosovo case, at Jewish reparations from the Holocaust and so on, and we see how international law is being applied in other refugee situations. Jewish communities are reclaiming properties stolen by the Nazis or their collaborators all over Europe, claiming lands back, and so, which is absolutely the right. and Palestinians are learning from all these experiences. Only when it comes to Palestinian refugee rights that it's looked upon as a, quote, demographic threat to Israel. In other words, there's some divine right given to Israel to maintain an ethnocentric state at the expense of applying international law, which is absolutely unacceptable. The third issue, which you rightly mentioned, is the right of Palestinians within Israel to full equality. I'll just tell a story. I was giving a lecture on BDS at the University of Manchester, and I explained the three rights, ending occupation, ending racial discrimination, and the right of return. And a very right-wing Zionist rabbi gets up and says, right of return, I understand. I'm opposed to it, but I understand. Occupation, I understand. It's that second one, ending racial discrimination within Israel and asking for full equality, that I see as really dangerous. I said, why is that? He said, isn't this code for the destruction of Israel? Why don't you just be honest and say it, that the BDS movement wants to destroy Israel? So I stepped back and said, let me deconstruct what you just said.
That's an amazing statement. I would have never thought that would be the thing he focused on.
Exactly. I said, a full equality would destroy Israel. What does that say about Israel? Did full equality destroy South Africa, as in physically destroying the people of South Africa, including the Afrikaners? Did full equality destroy any people anywhere in the U.S. South, for example? Did ending segregation end white existence in the southern states of the United States? Why is it only in Israel where this double standard comes forth?
Let's unpack that for one second, because, you know, we all hear, read in the newspapers all the time, Israel is the only, they call it a Jewish democratic state, contradiction or not.
An oxymoron.
Right. But they claim it's the only Jewish democratic state or only democratic state in that entire region. Now, what you're saying really is it whatever they mean by democratic, it certainly is not democratic.
Absolutely not.
For the 20% of the Palestinians who live there. Can you tell us in some ways that it's not?
Sure. Even if we forget what the UN says, even if we forget what main human rights organizations are saying, and they're all saying that Israel has laws, at least 30 laws, that directly or indirectly discriminate in a systematic way against the non-Jewish citizens of the State of Israel, the indigenous Palestinian Arabs. Even the State Department, in its annual human rights report, including the very last one of last year, has always consistently condemned Israel's institutional, I'm quoting, institutional, societal, and legal discrimination against the Palestinian minority. That fits the definition of apartheid in the UN Convention for the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, which was passed in 1973 and went into effect in 1976. So when we say Israel is practicing apartheid, we're not saying it's identical to South Africa. Of course it's not. But the fact that it has institutionalized, legalized discrimination makes it an apartheid state.
I think that's really crucial. And you make that point in your book. We're again talking with Omar Barghouti, the author of Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. And you make that point a lot in your book about apartheid. You say, well, people are shying away from it in the United States and other places. They don't want to call it that. And yes, sure, there are distinctions with South Africa, but it really fits the UN definition. And there's, of course, an ICC, International Criminal Court, Rome Statute as well. And what you've just said, of course, within Israel, there's an institutionalized oppression. And there's one in the occupied territories. But give us some examples.
So a Palestinian, like my wife, who was born in Israel and lived all her life in Israel and is an Israeli citizen, can never become a national.
Fascinating.
Any Jewish person from New York can go tomorrow and become a national immediately, and it's his state, even if he's in New York.
That's always been remarkable to me.
Palestinians cannot, in Israel, citizens of Israel, cannot buy, rent, or live on about 93% of the land of the State of Israel, which is reserved for the Jews only. For
most people just ignore that. I mean, it's clear if you look at all that you know that. And here you're saying it, 93% of the land is not accessible to call a citizen.
Absolutely. And in many other areas, in health, in education is a good example. Human Rights Watch issued this excellent watershed study in 2001 called Second Class, discrimination against Palestinians in the Israeli education system. Their main conclusion was that from kindergarten to college, Israel's discrimination acts like a set of sieves that have finer and finer holes as you move up towards college, filtering out more and more Palestinians so that you have a very small percentage on top during college years. And it's a very nice metaphor for exactly how they're systematically filtering out Palestinians to maintain a Jewish majority education system. So discrimination goes across the board in Israel. The fact that Palestinian citizens of Israel can vote becomes a form of tokenism of sorts, really. When you have discrimination in education, health, land ownership, jobs, everything. In many jobs, you have to serve in the army in order to get that job, and Palestinians do not serve in the army. So it's an indirect way of saying that. Now they've come up with an even more creative formula. They say Hebrew must be your mother tongue to get certain jobs in Israel. And they just passed a law whereby Jewish communities within Israel can maintain ethnic purity, rejecting Palestinians who want to apply and have housing in those areas based on, quote, cultural grounds.
I saw that. I was really shocked. There's a bunch of really even more retrograde laws going on right now, as yes. you mentioned in the book as well.
Yeah, Israel has always been a very sophisticated apartheid, unlike South Africa. Now it's even losing that. It's losing the veneer of sophistication and nuance. It's becoming just a brute form of apartheid with the loyalty oaths and with this...
The loyalty oath did pass?
Yes, the loyalty oath did pass.
Why don't you just tell us what that is, because it's so shocking to me.
The loyalty oath basically says that if you're not Jewish and you apply for citizenship in Israel, you have to take a loyalty oath to say that you are loyal to the state as a Jewish and democratic state.
I love it.
Jews don't have to do that. Because as you might know, ultra-Orthodox Jews would never accept to define Israel as a Jewish state because they are waiting for the Messiah to come to establish a real Jewish state. And so on religious grounds, they reject that. But they're not required by this law. This only applies to the Palestinians.
Amazing.
After this law passed, the loyalty oath, many mainstream Israeli artists, academics, playwrights, and so on accused the establishment of descending into fascism. And this is a term that's being used much more often now. I've argued that this is very exaggerated, that Israel is not yet a fascist state. There are some fascist tendencies, certainly, including in the government. But I think the Zionist left in Israel was hit very hard by this loss of the masks of democracy, that Israel is looking much, much worse around the world. It has lost already the battle for hearts and minds. So it's just resorting to bigger and bigger sticks, and it has lost any sight of the carrot and even how to use a carrot.
I think that's a really amazing description, and I want to bring you back to BDS and where it is. You were one of the early founders of the BDS movement.
Yes.
You founded a particular aspect of it. So I'd like to talk about really two things. One is, where do you see the movement going right now? And then talk about your particular expertise, or at least in the academic and cultural boycott, which of course is probably, if you were to talk to people I know, they would say, Michael, we like BDS, we even like it for more than the occupied territories, but I'm not so sure about the cultural and the academic. So I'll start wherever you'd like. But
okay, I'll start with your first part, where BDS is going. BDS started in 2005, so in less than 6 years, we've achieved much more than our South African comrades had achieved in 20 years. And people forget that because we often hear, especially in the U.S., oh, but in the South African anti-apartheid movement, it was so different. It was massively supported by churches, unions, and so on. People have very selective or very short memories. The South African boycott started in the 1950s. It took 25 to 30 years to become mainstream, to reach the unions and the churches and Congress members and so on.
People thought it was hopeless for years.
Exactly.
I was a kid growing up. We thought it was never going to change. It never happened.
Yeah, and I said that yesterday at Columbia. I was at Columbia in the anti-apartheid movement, and I used to hold up the sign, abolish apartheid. And then somebody would ask me, do you really believe that this will happen in your lifetime? And I said, no, of course not. But who cares? It's a moral obligation. I stand with the people of South Africa against apartheid, regardless if it will happen in my lifetime. It's basic human solidarity. But it did happen in my lifetime. So no one can take that hope away from us. It did happen in our life. We saw apartheid crumbling in South Africa. There's no reason why not to be optimistic about it crumbling in Israel as well, especially after the Egyptian and Tunisian revolutions.
I was going to ask that as one of my final questions, but go to that. That's pretty remarkable.
It's very connected. It has emboldened us. It has inspired us tremendously. Israel is losing its white complicity umbrella. It's losing its main allies in the region. And it couldn't continue its three-tiered system of oppression, occupation, apartheid, and denial of refugee rights without an Arab complicity umbrella, which Mubarak, the former president of Egypt, was the key figure in. One example of the immediate changes that happened after Mubarak is that Obama, the Obama administration, had to veto its own position at the UN. When a few weeks ago, the Palestinians and the Arab League pushed for a UN Security Council resolution recognizing settlements as illegal and an obstacle to peace, which is the standard position of the United States government for decades. Nothing there that's controversial. Right. Obama had to veto it because there's no longer Mubarak to do the dirty work for him.
Well, explain that a little bit. I understand.
If Mubarak were still around, he would pressure the Palestinian leadership, the unelected leadership, to pull out that motion, as happened with the Goldstone Report and so on and so forth.
I got you, because that's perfect. Because I read some editorials and they said, the Palestinians made a mistake. They shouldn't have pushed the resolution. They shouldn't have forced the U.S. to veto. And your point really explains it to me, because what you're saying is in the old days, Mubarak would have pushed them out of
exactly.
the resolution.
They wouldn't have reached the Security Council.
Right.
Now, the U.S. embarrassed itself, and it sat in this little dark corner with Israel, facing the entire world.
That was an amazing moment.
So we're back to that moment when Israel and the U.S. are completely isolated in the international community. This is refreshing.
Tunisia and Egypt, I just felt, was for the Palestinians, just has the potential for just being a major breaking open.
Absolutely. And we are extremely inspired. Going back to your second part of the question about academic and cultural boycott, and I think this is the least understood, and I try to explain that a lot in the book.
And the book, let me just say, we're talking to Omar Barghouti, the author of Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. And we're talking particularly about academic and cultural boycott. And the book actually has the calls for the academic and cultural boycott as part of the appendix of the book.
Exactly. So the academic and cultural boycott actually started in 2004, even before the general BDS call. And until now, it forms a very key part of the BDS movement. As you said, many even pro-Palestinian voices have asked us, are you out of your minds? Boycotting the Israeli Academy, isn't that irrational? Aren't you shooting yourself in the foot? Isn't the Academy at the forefront of the struggle to end the occupation? This is an absolute myth created by the Zionist left in Israel and propagated throughout. In real fact, the Academy in Israel is not even as bad as the rest of society. It's much, much worse. It has played a key role in planning, implementing, justifying, and whitewashing Israel's occupation, apartheid, and ethnic cleansing. It still does. And I'll just give a few examples. But before giving the examples, I want to explain that the boycott call is the least understood in the academic and cultural field, because many people say, but this will infringe academic freedom. You're preventing Israeli academics from coming to conferences and going around and doing research and publishing. Absolutely not. The academic and cultural boycott call is an institutional call. People are confusing it with South Africa. In South Africa, it was a blanket boycott against everyone and everything South African, including individuals. In the Palestinian call for academic and cultural boycott, it's simply against institutions, not against individuals. There's nothing to prevent an Israeli poet or writer or academic to go to festivals and so on. What we're targeting is institutional link to complicit Israeli institutions, be them cultural, academic, or otherwise.
A link with an orchestra in Israel, a link with Tel Aviv University or something.
Exactly, because these are groups, whether orchestras or universities or dance groups, that are complicit. Complicit in many, many ways, from simple silence, the complicity of silence, to actually participating in the Brand Israel campaign. To explain just...
I do think that's a key point you've made, and I want to repeat it. That you're not talking about targeting an individual who comes here from Israel and wants to read a poem.
Exactly.
What you're targeting is the institutions that are in Israel that are really part and parcel of the system of apartheid.
Exactly. So let's just give a concrete example. When the Bat Sheva Dance Company, which is the leading Israeli dance company, came to the United States to perform last year and the year before, it was faced by protests from BDS groups, Adala New York, and many other groups across the U.S., protested and called for boycotting their shows because Bat Sheva came with Israeli government funding specifically to whitewash Israel's crimes committed in Gaza in 2008-2009. So this is part of what Israel calls the Brand Israel campaign. It's a public campaign. We know all about it. What we found out about it, which we did not know until 2007, is that, and thanks to an Israeli writer who exposed it in Haaretz, there's a contract that Israeli artists, poets, academics, writers who go on tour with Israeli official money have to sign. They actually sign a contract that they shall not oppose the policy of the State of Israel, and they will do their best to promote the interests of the State of Israel. That shifts that person from being a cultural figure or an academic to being an agent of the State of Israel.
A propagandist, essentially.
A propagandist, and therefore worthy of boycott. Then we're not dealing with an individual, we're dealing with an agent of the State of Israel, a propagandist, that's doing an official job for the State of Israel. But otherwise, any academic, any artist who goes to any festival, any conference, without any institutional links to the State of Israel or its complicit organizations and institutions, is not boycottable, according to the boycott call. But going back to the myth, Professor Yehuda Shenav, an Israeli-Jewish professor, did the research, actually, a few years ago, about what percentage of Israeli academics have ever stood up against the occupation. And he found out that it was a very minuscule portion. Hundreds of Israeli academics out of a community of 9,000 have ever protested the occupation, signed a petition against the occupation, or done anything public against the occupation, let alone ending apartheid in Israel or the right of return for refugees. Even more recently, in 2008, four Jewish Israeli professors launched a petition addressed to the Israeli military authorities in the territories. They did not even call them the occupied territories, lest they offend. So addressed to the authorities in the territories, asking them to allow Palestinian students and professors access to their schools and colleges without hampering access. Basic, minimal academic freedom that you would think any self-respecting academic would support. They sent this petition to all 9,000 Israeli academics. 407 only signed it.
Wow.
Out of 9,000 academics, less than 5% of Israeli academics saw it fitting to sign a petition asking the army not to hamper access of students and professors to their colleges and schools. That's the level of the academy's complicity. But just to give two quick examples of the level of partnership in crime, and it is really partnership in war crimes, the Hebrew University, the most important and prestigious in Israel, has one of its two campuses built almost entirely on occupied Palestinian land in East Jerusalem. This means, and it has moved professors and students from Israel to the occupied territories in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. So the Hebrew University itself is guilty of war crimes, according to the Fourth Geneva Convention. It's not complicit, it's itself.
No, that's completely correct. I mean, I'm a lawyer and I know that what the convention says about occupied territories.
So that's a direct infringement of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Tel Aviv University developed through a series of workshops with the army and the military industry the doctrine called the doctrine of disproportionate force, which was used to target Palestinians in Gaza end of 2008-2009. And what this says basically is that since Israel cannot effectively combat irregular resistance forces like Hamas, the most effective way is to obliterate as much civilian infrastructure as possible and make civilians suffer so much that they will do Israel's bidding and stop the resistance and tell them, you know, we've suffered enough, stop fighting back.
Disproportional force and collective punishment.
You know, when the UN and Amnesty say, oh, we accuse Israel of disproportionate force, hello, that's what they call it.
Right.
That's the name of the doctrine. That was developed at Tel Aviv University.
So I want to have another look at BDS. BDS, as you said, there's three clear demands. I'm interested in two aspects of it. One is, where's the leadership coming from on BDS? There's all kinds of BDS out there, people who say, well, BDS just for the occupied territories, BDS, we'll just boycott products from the occupied territories. And I'm just interested in your thoughts about that. Where's the leadership and different levels of people's participation in BDS?
There's only one BDS. It's a Palestinian-led movement. It has a leadership called the BDS National Committee, or BNC, which is a very large coalition, the largest coalition in Palestinian civil society, made up of trade union federations, women's groups, refugee groups, political parties. Everyone is in it.
Hundreds of groups. I mean, you have them in your book. I mean, everybody.
In it. I mean, that those not inside the DNC, you can put them in a short list. So this is the Palestinian leadership of the global BDS movement. But BDS is not a political party. It's not an ideology. It's not a dogmatic movement. It's based on the three principles: ending occupation, ending apartheid, and the right of return. That's the principle that everyone has to agree with. When it comes to implementation of boycott and divestment initiatives, the main operational principle is context sensitivity, which means our partners know best their territory. They know best what targets to choose and how to go about them. So if Code Pink, let's say, is focusing on Ahava, a particular Israeli company that's manufacturing in the occupied territories.
That's the company that does makeup and stuff from the Dead Sea, right?
Yes, from Dead Sea, using Palestinian stolen minerals in the occupied territories. That's perfectly fine. That's an excellent example of a very successful BDS campaign. When Jewish Voice for Peace, which has not yet endorsed BDS actually, but is leading one of the major BDS campaigns in this country, that targeting TIAA CREF, the large pension fund, pressuring them to divest from five companies profiting from Israel's occupation. That's a perfect example of a BDS campaign. The thing about this campaign is that nowhere does Jewish Voice for Peace undermine the three principles of the BDS call, despite the fact that they have not yet endorsed BDS. Now, there are voices, especially in the liberal, so-called liberal Zionist communities in this country, that are saying, oh, but that BDS is too harsh and too radical. We need to come up with something less severe, more nuanced, that forgets the Palestinian three principles and just focuses on the occupation. That is a very colonial, patronizing position. Those who think that they can decide for the Palestinians what our basic rights are, ignoring international law and universal principles of human rights, are racist. I have no other word for them. They're racist, simply. By saying that, oh, Palestinians should just, you know, forget about two-thirds of their people and just focus on the one-third under occupation because it suits my liberal Zionist agenda, well, it suits your agenda, so you're in solidarity with yourself, not with the Palestinians.
That's why we have a movement led by Palestinians.
Exactly.
You're here in the United States for how long, and what are you doing here? And tell us a little bit about getting here.
Okay, I'm here on a book tour, speaking and promoting the book. And as I've said several times, I'm shamelessly promoting it because the proceeds, the author's proceeds, are all going to PACBI, the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, not to myself. So buying the book is also helping the BDS movement. But even those opposed to BDS, I really recommend that they buy the book and read it, at least to sound smart when they oppose it. Because there's no attempt to sound smart. Many of the counter-BDS arguments are just purely dumb. Really, very low IQ arguments out there. So I suggest people get educated a bit so that they can put together a semi-intelligent argument against BDS. They can try at least. So I'm promoting the book. I'm speaking mainly at universities. So I think the main objective is to promote the book. And it's not just yet another book. It's a living movement that's growing tremendously, and especially in the last couple of years after the attack on Israeli attack on Gaza. BDS has grown tremendously, especially in Europe.
Omar Barghouti, the book is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. And my own plug for it is, even someone like me who's, you know, somewhat well-versed in Palestinian issues and the legal issues, it's really provocative. And even if you are startled by some things you'll read in there, it's really important book to read because it really lays out in the best way I've seen why BDS is so critical. So Omar, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.